It was a fine, sunny day in the year 1923. I was looking after a sheep on the hillside, the sun yellowing in the west and a lark singing above. I raised my head and listened. "Indeed, little bird, small as you are, you have me beguiled," said I to myself. I walked west along the ditch, whistling softly. I had gone about 20 yards when I thought I saw a man approaching me, a man whose like was not in the blasket. I stopped, looking intently. "By God," said I to myself, "you are there sure enough. And if it is from the other world you have come, you seem not to be poor." I thought I saw a smile on his face. "Faith, there's no bad look on you anyway." He was now only 40 yards away, a man neither too tall nor too short, with knee breeches and a shoulder cloak, his head bare and a shock of dark brown hair gathered straight back on it. I was growing afraid. Where had he come from, and he approaching me now from the top of the hill in the darkening of the day? I leant my back against the bank of the ditch. I drew out my pipe and lit it. I heard a voice behind me. "God save you," it said. I looked round. He was smiling. "God and Mary save you, noble person," said I. He sat down in a stone beside me and drew out a box of cigarettes. "Will you have one?" said he, in English. "I will not, thank you," said I, in Irish. We both remained silent for a long time. Then he tried to say something in Irish, but failed. Then he turned again to the English. "What do you call that place over there?" said he in a very hard accent. "They call it Valentia Island," said I. "And how would you say that in Irish?" I told him. He took from his pocket a little book and a pencil and wrote down quickly what I had said. "Faith, my lad," said I to myself, "this is not the first time you wrote Irish, anyway." When he had finished, I spoke to him. "Where are you from, may I ask?" He bent his head for a moment, muttering the words under his teeth. Then he answered in English. "I am from London, and I came to the Blasket today," said he with a laugh. "The laugh of an Englishman," said I to myself. "Isn't it often I was told to beware of it?" He asked my name, I told him. "Mine is George Thompson," said he, in Irish. "I'm thinking you of Irish, too," said I. "A little," said he, with another laugh. It was growing dark, and we moved east towards the village. "Where are you staying?" said I. He stopped for a moment to think. "I am in the house of Michael Gaheen. Is that right?" "It is," said I. George and I spent the next 6 weeks walking together on strand, hill, and mountain, and after spending that time in my company, he had fluent Irish. If everyone in Ireland were as eager as he for the language, the people of all Ireland would be Gaels again without much delay. One fine morning, my father and I were at breakfast. "Faith," said my father, "it would be a good day to bring home those two sheep that are west on Red Ridge." As we walked up the causeway, we met George coming down. "Where are you going today?" said he. "I'm going into the hill with my father to bring home two sheep." "I'll come with you." "Ah, you won't? No, for you would fall from the cliffs." "I will not," said he, turning on his heel and accompanying us. We walked into the hill as happy as children, talking and conversing, giving words of Irish to George till we reached Red Ridge. We sat down to rest, looking south to the Skelligs. "Isn't this place very different from the city of London?" said my father. "It is indeed," said George. "It's a pity I'm not in the city of London now," said I, "for it's a fine view I would have." "What's that?" said George, turning to me with a frown of surprise. "Indeed you would not, but the heat killing you and your health failing for want of air. And as for the view, you'd be looking out at the same thing always. People walking the streets with nothing in them, only the breath. And believe me, if one of them could see this view out before me now, he would give his riches for it." "You are right," said my father. I got up. "The two of ye had better wait here now until I go north to Halbert Hollow after the old yo," said I. "Very well," said my father. I went north through the Scornoch and down through the Ferdon, a dizzy ravine above and beneath me, and the sea far below dashing against the rocks. Many sheep were around me here and there, but my own old yo was not among them. She was easy to recognize, for she had not been shorn. She was a good climber, so I made my way to the cliffs. There was nothing beneath my feet but the blue sea, and the slightest stumble would have sent me headlong, a sauce for the crabs below. Suddenly I felt the earth shaking beneath my feet. Looking up, I saw the sky blackened by a big black mass of turf. "God save my soul," I cried, "it'll strike me surely." I leapt aside. It rushed past me with a terrible whirl. I watched it hurtling down the cliff till at last it struck the water. A spurt of foam leapt into the air and fell down again with a splash which made the whole cliff ring. In a moment the birds were in a tumult, chattering excitedly, like any nation of men fleeing for their lives from an earthquake. I moved west across Fern Bottom. There I saw my old shred of a yo down on the lowest ledge. When I was 20 yards from her, I stopped and shouted. She lifted her head slowly, but that was all the heed she gave me. I took a stone and threw it at her. It struck her in the middle of the back. Away she ran up the cliff. I followed breathlessly after her. She was wild with fright, and what wonder, a sheep which had not been caught for 3 years and had spent all that time among the ravines, only fit for the birds of the sea. I kept her in sight, that at last she tripped up and came tumbling head over heels like a snowball. Her 4 feet were in the air, kicking wildly. "Faith, you look very uncomfortable," said I, catching her and lifting her up. I was between two minds now. Would I keep her or let her go? If I keep her, I said to myself, both she and I would be thrown into the sea. So I let her follow her nose through the cliff, I running behind. By now she was so exhausted she could hardly put one leg before another. Musha, how my heart opened when I got a draught of the fine, sweet air which was flowing across the summit from the Skellig. I sat down in a clump of grass, tired out. I looked round for my father and George, but I couldn't see them. I put a finger in my mouth and whistled. Then I saw George getting up out of the fern, smiling as usual. He came up to me. "Oh," said he, stretching himself, "the sun has me killed," and he threw himself into the fern beside me. "Listen," said I to George, "don't stir out of that, and whatever you do, don't let that old ewe north again." He got up in surprise. "Where are you going? Don't you see my father? He's finding that sheep too much for him, and I'm going to help him. But, divil, don't let that old ewe north." I went down the hill towards the palm. I ran the sheep down, and the two of us drove it east as far as the White Stones. "I wonder," said I, "could you keep her here till I go and bring in the other from the north?" I went back to the place where I had left George and the old yo. When I came in sight of the Scornoch, what did I see but George, coat in hand, running as fast as he could after about 200 sheep across Red Ridge. I stopped and looked at him. Wasn't it a great and wonderful work he had in hand to bring those 200 together? I scratched my head in amazement. "Oh, Lord," said I, "the yo I'm after bringing from the north is amongst those as sure as I live, and that's why he is pursuing them." I looked up to the place where I had left the yo, and there she was still. I was lost in wonder. What in the world possessed him to run after those? I whistled and whistled again, but he gave no heed. "As sure as I live, and there's a cross on an ass," said I, "it's over the cliff you'll go." I shouted in the height of my head. Just then I saw him throwing his coat after them. Then he went head over heels into the heather. My heart leapt. When I was within 20 yards of him, he got up and looked round. When he saw me, he gave a fine, hearty laugh. "Upon my soul, George, you are the man who slew 100. Oh, Morris, I had to let them go. Araman, what came over you to keep a watch on those shorn sheep?" Didn't you tell me yourself? He asked in wonder. I did not. I told you to watch the ewe I brought from the north. Oh, I see. And where's that ewe now? There, in the same place still. But come now till we drive the wild ewe east, for my father is waiting for us at the Sharra Rocks for the other one. We got the two sheep together. At last we reached Shingle Strand, where the sheep to be rounded up. Rose was out before us, barking furiously, till she had driven the two into the cave of Siobhan de Londres. I told George to stand at the mouth, and if either of the sheep tried to escape, to seize it. Very well, said he, stretching out his arms to each side of the cave. I made a dash for the sheep. I caught one and threw it, but the other got away. I looked round and saw it making for the sea, with George clinging to its tail. "Your sword to the devil," I shouted. "Let her go, or she'll drown you." He let go of her at last. Rose swam out and rounded her in. When I returned after getting her into the cave again, George was wringing the water from his stockings. When we had the sheep shorn, "Well, George," said my father, "you must be hungry now." I was never so hungry in my life. "Isn't it hard work we have here after the sheep?" said I. "No doubt of it. And so great wonder no one falls from the cliffs after them."